Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about today, including what's behind a big drop in emergency room visits at local hospitals, new thinking on asthma and coronavirus, and the value of telehealth these days. But first, let's start the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us.
Always happy to.
Lots of talk about some controversial statements made by President Trump in his Thursday briefing at the White House regarding heat and humidity and sunlight and disinfectant as possible treatments for coronavirus. Here's what he said.
Supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And I think you said you're going to test that too. Sounds interesting.
We'll get the right folks who could.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that? By injection inside or almost a cleaning, because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number in the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
Dr. Buchholz, what's your response?
So, I think, first of all, you know, it's right in the sense that ultraviolet radiation does kill this virus. It kills all virus at a sufficient of concentration. We're using it to sanitize some of our equipment, our personal protective equipment in the hospital, at much higher levels that are safe for humans. And we do have, you know, there's probably a fair amount of people that listen to this that have had radiation treatment before. That is how we use essentially light. It's radioactive light that kills cancer cells. And the side effects of that are so severe sometimes that we really work hard, and the equipment now is so good at really targeting these small cells to minimize the damage done everywhere else. And so, you know, it just is not it's not a treatment option that really is going to have benefit. And probably, again, we keep on talking about benefit versus harms. The harms here are so obvious that it's just not worth talking about. And same thing with disinfectant. I mean, I think that quickly came out to say that is exceedingly dangerous to do that. A huge number of toxic chemicals that if in the bloodstream could cause gosh knows what type of damage. It's not a good idea, either one of those. I'll just leave it at that.
Here's a little bit of what the FDA director, Stephen Hahn, told CNN's Sanjay Gupta.
And no, I certainly wouldn't recommend the internal ingestion of a disinfectant.
Dr. Hahn, I think we should be clear, though, that the idea of doing some kind of UV light therapy, which is sometimes used for local issues in the body but not for a widespread viral infection, and the idea of injecting disinfectant, I mean, those questions may be getting asked, but there's absolutely no merit to that. That doesn't need to be studied. You can already say that doesn't work, right?
And I think, Sanjay, that is exactly what a patient would say to a doctor, and that would be the answer of the medical experts to anybody who answered that question.
President Trump, meanwhile, now says he was being sarcastic when making those comments.
No, I was asking a question sarcastically to reporters like you just to see what would happen.
There are new studies out, preliminary studies, Dr. Buchholz, looking at the use of hydroxychloroquine and remdesivir as a possible treatment for coronavirus, and they're not too optimistic. CNN medical correspondent Elizabeth Cohen tells us about that, beginning with remdesivir.
This was a drug where there was a lot of hope, but it appears, based on something that was posted on the World Health Organization, that those results either showed that it didn't work or that it was inconclusive. Either way, it didn't show, yep, we tried it and it worked. And these were very sick patients. Maybe it would work earlier in the stage of the illness, but for these sick patients, it appears that it either didn't work or that it was inconclusive. Another drug we've been paying a lot of attention to is hydroxychloroquine. And last night, Governor Cuomo announced that a study in New York, a large study that was much anticipated, showed that it didn't seem to have an effect.
Dr. Buckle, what do you think?
Well, I guess I'll start about the hydroxychloroquine first. I mean, I think that's been now becoming pretty well established that there is no evidence of benefit and there is some evidence of harm, and that's still not consistently reported in trials. And kind of goes back to the initial science done on hydroxychloroquine was poorly done. And when I say poorly done, that's being generous to that science. It just would not meet our normal standards. You know, again, even knowing that we're trying to find therapies and trying to be a little bit more flexible about those standards, this was just the work, particularly out of France, was just abysmal. So that's not surprising. The remdesivir is interesting. So, I mean, there's been reports here and there of success, but not by what I would call good trial evidence. They're just kind of anecdotal reports. This was a study that was published quickly on the World Health Organization website and then quickly taken down. But they didn't really say, you know, the methods or how this was done. Just said it was a negative study. So you'd like to see the report and look at the data to get a better sense of things before you make any big conclusions. Again, the United States is undergoing a major trial for remdesivir. Those results aren't going to be due until May, but that is a big, big trial with lots of patients involved and, you know, good method behind it. So, you know, if that was negative, then I'd be pretty impressed and to say this is might not be a drug that has effect, but time will tell on that. I don't think there's any way to make any kind of conclusion about remdesivir at this point.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buckle. Dr. Buckle is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buckhold, officials in Franklin County have now lifted restrictions on some businesses there. What do you think about that?
Well, again, I think there's cause to be a little optimistic in terms of the numbers in the St. Louis region, and that's a success. I certainly understand the pressures to try to get things back to normal. I mean, the unemployment rate continues to rise. I just think it's a little premature still. And again, you know, I can kind of understand if you want to open up businesses of kind of, you know, maybe some more, you know, not essential, but helpful services, you know, so, you know, cleaners or other things where you just need things done for your household. In Franklin County, it seems to be concert venues and golf courses and bowling alleys. I'm just not sure what the urgency to open those up are, and I don't understand the logic. I'm concerned that this is going to cause more infections, and that's bothersome to me.
And you would prefer we just stay the course?
Yes. I think we can start having the conversation about how we go about getting out of this and going back to doing things at least as normal as a new normal will be. But that's the conversation, not actually implementing that. I think we still need to make sure we're still having new cases every day. The curve is certainly flattened, it seems like, but it's not like we've reached our peak, I don't think, yet. You know, I think we need a little bit more time to see how this plays out. And then as we do this, grading it out, being cautious about it. And again, I think it's so, so important to have the testing in place as a kind of the next piece of tactics to use in order to kind of identify when things happen and kind of identify potential sources very, very quickly. I think that's so, so important. That's on play. And I'm worried about Franklin County. I mean, I think, you know, they have 100 reported cases or so. They have 10 or so deaths, which gives a 10% death rate, which is quite high. That's not saying that's the actual death rate. That says that they probably have underestimated how many patients really have COVID. As far as I know, there's one healthcare facility there that has about 100 beds. There's 100 beds in the healthcare system there. That's an area that will get overwhelmed very, very quickly. And they, you know, those patients inevitably come to the St. Louis area. And so, you know, this just shows that everything is kind of interwoven. It's not just this one county in isolation. It affects everybody else around it in potential ways. And that's it's frustrating. I'll just leave it at that.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is going to require all Illinois residents to wear masks in public starting May 1st.
Any individual over the age of 2 and able to medically tolerate a face covering or mask will be required to wear one when in a public place where they can't maintain a 6-foot social distance.
Good idea?
Yeah, sure. Again, I'm less sold on the ability of facial masks to really reduce spread, but it, again, the upside is enough and the downside is minimal enough that I'm not against it either. It makes sense. It adds an extra thing of protection. It probably gives people that psychological safety a little bit too. My biggest worry with this, I'm not against the masks per se. My biggest worry is it makes people, the reverse psychology of it makes you a little less cautious, and I think that's what I'm, that's my biggest concern with it. But it's not a bad policy. I'm not absolutely against it.
Doctors are trying to untangle why they're seeing unprecedented blood clotting among some COVID-19 patients. What do you think's going on there?
Well, it's interesting. And again, it's certainly something people have noted. You know, that being said, when people are extremely sick, the risk for blood clots are quite high. And so it's something we see and practice and try to prevent as much as possible. The one thing you always have to be cautious when you see kind of these kind of responses, when we as doctors notice something or somebody notices something, is it just a statistical chance or just a kind of a fake pattern, so to speak, or is it a true pattern? And the way to really tell that is to, you know, kind of look at data and do some careful statistics to make sure that this is really some association that's there rather than just kind of anecdotal. It seems to be kind of a shared experience amongst a lot of different people that have seen a lot of patients with COVID, you know, in New York and elsewhere. So it's something that, you know, a lot of talk has been going on about this, how to effectively treat this and how to effectively prevent it. Do we need to change our tactics in doing that? And that's a topic of discussion. And you know, there's some research starting to be started on this. So it's something that's noted. Whether it's really a true fact or not, I think remains to be seen. The challenge of this, obviously, is, you know, we're kind of trying to deal with this in real time and make adjustments how we treat this. So it becomes another question of, do you get more aggressive with this or not? And again, knowing that while it seems reasonably aggressive, the other thing is, you know, these are giving blood thinning medicines and they can kill you as well. They're very dangerous if not handled well. And even handled well, there's a risk of bleeding with that can be fatal. So it's not like an easy decision to make by any stretch of imagination.
Dr. Buchholz, we heard earlier this week about the possibility of COVID-19 and the flu hitting at the same time this winter. What do we need to know about that?
You know, when the flu hits every year, and it does, you know, particularly in December and January, we, you know, hospitals in the St. Louis area get full. The ERs are full. The hospital beds are full. We really work hard to get people better and get them out of the hospital. And, you know, the second a person gets out of the bed, there's, you know, one or two or sometimes even three or four patients somewhere ready to take up that same bed. And so it's a busy, busy time. And we're kind of used to that. And that's just kind of the pattern of work we're used to at this point. You know, what we see with COVID is not only just the people, amount of people that get sick, but the amount of people that get sick at one time, because this seemingly spreads so darn quickly amongst the population that, you know, again, the experience in New York or Seattle or Wuhan shows it just, you know, all of a sudden you're just overwhelmed. And so you add that to a busy flu season and you can just see how the potential for disaster gets really, really high. So we've got to be ready for this. And, you know, any failure not to be ready is just inexcusable in my mind. So, you know, that work should be going on now, frankly. And I'm glad they're at least talking about it because it's going to be here before we even know it.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot. Really appreciate all the time you spend with us.
Oh, no, thank you, Fred. Appreciate it.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk about how ER visits are way down during this time of COVID-19. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Many local hospitals are reporting fewer emergency room visits because of the COVID-19 outbreak. Let's talk about that with Dr. Robert Poyer. Dr. Poyer is a Washington University emergency medicine physician and director of the emergency department at Barnes Jewish Hospital. Dr. Poyer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what's it like at the Barnes Jewish ER these days?
Actually, we've been doing quite well. We're seeing about 60 COVID or COVID-like patients a day out of the 180 patients that come every day right now. Before or pre-COVID, we would see on average about 240 patients. So our volume is down anywhere from 25% to 30%. We've instituted very good triaging and sorting parameters so that we're keeping everybody safe, whether you have COVID symptoms or whether you do not have COVID symptoms and you're having other emergent symptoms that need to be dealt with.
Yeah, tell me about that. Why do you think the numbers are down? Do you think people are afraid to come into the ER?
Definitely. I think people are watching TV and seeing what's going on in New York, all the chaos that's going on in the hospitals. That's definitely not the case here in St. Louis. We have it under control. It's very organized and orderly, and we do have capacity now. So I think people are afraid. They think that when they come into the emergency department, they're going to be exposed heavily to COVID or COVID patients. They're going to then get COVID if they're not having current symptoms. And that's definitely not the case. We haven't seen any of that, and we're processing thousands of patients every few weeks.
So with the numbers for ER visits down from 240 to about 180 a day, what do you think is happening to all those people?
I think, and we've seen, a lot of people are waiting it out at home, and that is very bad if you're having heart attacks or strokes or symptoms of heart attacks or strokes, or you've experienced trauma at home and you're trying to take care of it or heal it yourself. We've seen bad outcomes with people waiting too long, and we've seen people die or be permanently disabled. And if they had come into the emergency department sooner and into the hospital, we could have provided them treatment to prevent the possible deaths and disabilities that they're experiencing.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Poyer. He's director of the Barnes Jewish Emergency Department. He's also a WashU emergency medicine physician. Dr. Poyer, walk us through this. Let's say I'm coming in to be checked out for, like, I think I might be having an appendicitis attack. What am I going to see when I get there?
You'll meet our triage nurse. We put a mask on pretty much anybody that walks in the front door, definitely on people with symptoms of cough, fever, any of the COVID symptoms. If you're not having any of those symptoms, we'll then triage you back into one of the rooms. The rooms are individual. You're not in with anybody else if you're having appendicitis or abdominal pain. And then you'll be seen by the nurse and the doctor, and we will work you up with the lab tests and the x-rays or CT scans, and we'll also call down the specialist to come see you and take care of your appendicitis. If you don't have any COVID symptoms, you will go to our non-COVID floors in the hospital or non-COVID suites. We have COVID suites. We have people that have COVID symptoms that we're still waiting testing. And then we have people with no symptoms and no COVID, or their tests are negative, and we put them on our non-COVID floor. So you go to a non-COVID floor and have your illness or your appendicitis treated just as you would pre-COVID. It's very safe. We haven't had any staff to patient or patient to patient transmission in our emergency department.
Let's talk then about the COVID symptoms. What are the typical COVID symptoms that you're seeing people come in with?
A lot of people are coming in with shortness of breath, cough, runny nose, fevers, sometimes high fevers. People will be short of breath when they exert themselves walking around. Some people will have nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea as well.
Any of those things like loss of taste, loss of smell, that sort of thing?
Some people will have that. That's usually in addition to other symptoms they're having. Most people, are waiting until they're feeling really sick to come into the emergency department. And so most of the patients we're seeing have some sort of symptoms that they're complaining about that they think are related to COVID, and definitely in many cases are related.
Dr. Poyer, what's the main message you want people to know about the Barnes Jewish ER?
If you're having any concerning symptoms, anything that's different, chest pain, shortness of breath, any symptoms that are concerning to you and are not improving, definitely come and get checked out with us in the emergency department. Or if you have a primary care doctor and you're not experiencing emergent symptoms, call your primary care doctor. But we are in the emergency department open 24/7. We have a very good process to keep everybody safe, and we will work up the condition and treat it.
Is it still recommended to call before you go?
if you're having COVID symptoms, it's a good idea to call and give us a heads up. But you can come in without calling, and because we do the same process, we have the same process that we use on every patient coming to the front door.
Dr. Poirier, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert Poirier is an emergency medicine specialist at Washington University School of Medicine and director of the emergency department at Barnes Jewish Hospital. The sanitizing of those critical N95 masks just got a whole lot easier at one local hospital. Let's talk with Heather Jolly about that. Heather is the administrative director of nursing operations at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about what Cardinal Glennon is now doing when it comes to N95 masks.
So we've started a process where we're able to treat the masks with UV light, killing organisms, including the COVID virus.
So how does that work?
So the masks are able to be put underneath UV light, and the UV light actually kills the virus.
Where are you doing it?
So we were able to benefit from a donation from a local company called Pasco, and they were gifted us with a trailer that has UV light installed in it. So we're able to hang the masks inside the trailer, and the UV light treats all sides of the mask at the same time.
How many masks can you treat at the same time?
We're able to treat 180 masks at once, and all 180 masks can be done in about 10 minutes' time.
How many do you think you could do in a day?
We're able to process all of the masks that we need, and we can do about 1,000 in a day.
How big was the need for something like this?
Pretty significant. We have the need for our staff members to have N95 masks available to keep them safe. And prior to the donation of the trailer, it took us 2 minutes to process two masks, and that's all that we could do at a time. So being able to do 180 of them in 10 minutes is significant for the healthcare workers.
Does that help solve the problem of not enough N95 masks there?
It goes a long way toward it. With single-use masks, they can only be worn once. With this UV treatment, we're able to process them five times, extending the life for five additional wears.
Heather Jolly, thanks a lot for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Heather Jolly is the administrative director of nursing operations at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk about asthma and coronavirus. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
How worried should asthma patients be about their COVID-19 risk? Here to talk with us about that is Dr. James Wedner. Dr. Wedner is a professor of medicine and director of the Asthma and Allergy Center at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Wedner, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We are hearing that asthma is absent among the top COVID-19 risk factors. What are you hearing?
We're hearing about the same. There have been a number of reports now looking at the incidence of asthma among both those who have the disease, COVID-19, and those who really got sick with COVID-19. And the incidence of asthma is actually lower than one would expect from the incidence of asthma in the general population. So it doesn't seem as though asthma is a risk factor for acquiring or becoming infected with the virus, and it certainly doesn't seem that asthma is one of the comorbidities that we associate with more severe disease or bad outcomes in COVID-19.
Does that surprise you? Because COVID-19 is kind of a respiratory problem.
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. Early on, there was the supposition that asthma would be at least a risk factor. And the other problem that people worried about was the fact that most of our asthmatic patients are using inhaled corticosteroids. And the worry was that the steroids would make them more susceptible to the virus, to the infection. That turns out not to be true. Asthma is a disease of the tubes in the lung. COVID-19 is a viral pneumonia, which largely affects not only the tubes, but the air sacs. And it turns out that the tubes, the bronchioles, are not more susceptible to infection with the virus than in the normal population. There may actually be a slightly decrease, although it's too early to say that for sure.
What are you hearing are the most common risk factors for COVID-19?
Well, the risk factors for getting the disease is simply being exposed. For comorbidities, there are a lot of them. But the number one comorbidities are things like diabetes and heart disease. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease does seem to be a comorbidity, although asthma is not. So those are the main ones. And if you look, there was an article in the New York Times, you may have seen that, which kind of summarized all this. But there have now been a number of other publications, both in the United States, in Europe, and from Wuhan in China, all demonstrating that the bad comorbidities are things like diabetes and heart disease, and obesity seems to be a significant comorbidity, although, and as I mentioned, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Those are the biggies. And those, as you all know, age, people over the age of 60 or 65, tends to give you a worse outcome. So those are the at-risk populations.
And what do you mean by comorbidities?
Well, if you have a disease, another disease can make the first disease worse. So the second disease, so let's say you have a patient with COVID-19, and they also have obesity. That's a comorbidity, and it means that you have a higher risk for a bad outcome than you did without having the second health problem, in this case, obesity, bad heart disease, and other things that make you more susceptible to bad outcomes from the COVID virus.
We're talking with Dr. James Wedner. Dr. Wedner is a professor of medicine and director of the Asthma and Allergy Center at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Wedner, how many people have asthma?
In the United States, probably 30 million.
And what do you think those people should be doing now as they're trying to prevent getting coronavirus?
Well, all of us, including the asthmatics, and my asthma patients are no different, should be doing the same thing that everybody else should be doing. Social distancing is very important. I'm an allergist as well as an asthma specialist, and we say nobody's allergic to something that isn't there. Nobody can get COVID-19 if they're not exposed. So the best you can do is stay at home. If you must go out, wear a mask, stay away from people, the 6 feet or more distancing in stores or other areas is very important. These are the things that we're advising all of our patients to do. The other thing I think it's important for asthmatics is don't stop taking your medicine. The worst thing you could do would be to fear taking your medicine, particularly inhaled corticosteroids, which are the number one treatment for asthma. So we would advise all of our asthmatic patients, keep taking your medicine.
What about those who have allergies? How can they tell if what they're having is an allergy and not COVID-19?
Well, remember that as allergies are pretty specific. Right now, we're in the middle of the spring allergy season, itchy, scratchy, watery eyes, runny nose, drippy nose, itching of the tip of the nose is almost pathognomonic for allergies. Patients with allergies don't get fever. If you have asthma, you may be exposed and you may wheeze, but your wheezing should get better if you use your short-acting anti-asthma medicine, albuterol being the number one. These are the things that differentiate. As allergies don't cause muscle aches and pains, they don't, unless your nose gets stuffed up, they don't cause you to not being able to smell or taste. So people who have classic allergies, now is the time when they're starting to get symptoms. I'm sitting looking at the maple tree sitting outside my yard. It's filled with inflorescences giving out pollen. So it is important for all our allergy sufferers to remember, keep indoors just as you would for COVID. Keep the windows closed so the pollen doesn't get in. If you must walk out, remember pollen counts are higher in the morning than they are in the evening. So take your walk in the evening.
Dr. Wedner, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Nice talking to you.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
Dr. James Wedner is a professor of medicine and director of the Asthma and Allergy Center at Washington University School of Medicine. Coming up, we'll talk about the impact of telehealth on treating COVID-19 and all our other illnesses. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Even under stay-at-home regulations, patients still require access to the care they need. That's one of the reasons why SSM Health has expanded its telehealth options for patients. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Tim Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the System Vice President of Medical Group and Population Health Operations for SSM Health. Dr. Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So explain to me, what are you doing at SSM Health to expand telehealth options?
Maybe I'll start by giving us a little bit of a context. So we're all living under these new stay-at-home regulations, which have been put in place to try to keep ourselves safe and our community safe, our patients safe. And in that particular context, we realize that there are patients that still need care. Patients have chronic medical conditions and other issues that need to be taken care of, but it's not necessarily safe for them to go into an office and see their provider face-to-face. And we feel like by providing them with options to be able to connect with their providers, their physicians, their nurse practitioners or physician assistants through a televideo visit, we can still do a really good job of taking care of the patients, but keep them safe, keep the providers safe, the caregivers safe. So in that context, we really have kind of opened up options for our patients. You know, they can call their offices and they can get set up with a televideo visit. In some cases where they don't have the capability of a televideo visit, even a telephone visit can happen so they can make sure that they get the care that they need and they can stay healthy.
How would that work? Who would I call?
Yeah, so there are a couple of ways to access the televideo visits or the telehealth visits. One would be just calling your doctor's office and setting up a visit that way. They can get you set up with a televideo visit or a telephone visit. The other thing to do is you can go to the SSM website, which is ssmhealth.com. And, you know, there's a link there where you can schedule a telehealth visit. So a couple different ways to do that.
What sort of visits would this be ideal for?
So all sorts of visits. I think kind of the types of visits I think about are patients who have chronic high blood pressure issues. And so they need to check in with their provider to make sure that their medicine is adjusted appropriately, or somebody has, you know, some type of thyroid issue or cholesterol issue. And we can even do annual wellness visits through televideo visits. So these are kind of preventive types of visits where you have to think about what kind of cancer screening needs to be done, what kind of advanced care planning should happen. So really, almost any type of visit can happen through a televideo visit. There are some visits that don't necessarily lend themselves to televideo visit where a physical exam is necessary, but most chronic disease management can happen through a televideo visit.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the System Vice President of Medical Group and Population Health Operations at SSM Health. Dr. Johnson, are you still doing a lot of coronavirus calls or assessments on telehealth?
Yes, we are. So that is something that as patients need to be evaluated potentially for having COVID-19, we can do that through telehealth. Really, the easiest way to do that is to go on the website that I mentioned earlier, and there's a banner there. You can just click on it, and basically it's a virtual visit that will screen you for coronavirus or COVID-19, that's the disease, to see if you need to be evaluated further. But yeah, that's still happening.
Post-COVID-19, in that world that we all hope we get to shortly, how much of an impact do you think telehealth will have on our health care in the days, months, years to come?
So I think televisits or telemedicine, telehealth, I mean, it's here to stay. We had really good evidence that our younger populations wanted to do telehealth, televideo visits. There was some question whether or not our older patients would embrace that type of technology or that type of visit. But as we've done more and more of these televideo visits, all patients of all ages have really, really enjoyed being able to connect with their providers this way. So maybe to give you an example, before before the COVID pandemic started, very, very few of our visits were done through a televideo visit or through telephones. Now upwards of 30-40% are being done through televideo visits or telemedicine with really good feedback. So I think this has fundamentally changed the way our patients think about interacting with their providers. And just as importantly, I think the providers themselves, the physicians, the nurse practitioners, the physician assistants, have gotten comfortable with this technology. They've had some experience with it. And so now they're comfortable with it. Our patients are comfortable with it. I see it as a really important part of how we will deliver healthcare into the future.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you about. How does it change how a doctor does his or her job?
It is interesting. So when you go to medical school, when I went to medical school, I kind of always envisioned myself sitting in front of the patient, having that personal face-to-face connection, creating relationships. I think now with the televideo visits, it's a little bit of a shift in mindset for the providers, realizing, hey, I can still have a relationship with my patient, even though it may be through a screen. We can still take care of them the way they need to be taken care of. We think a little bit more broadly about what kind of things are appropriate to be taken care of through a televideo visit. It doesn't mean that face-to-face visits aren't important. That's still going to be an important component of some physical exams and some conditions. But moving forward, I think we'll be able to do a lot more of our follow-up visits through a televideo interaction rather than a face-to-face interaction.
And I think that's pretty critical right now as well, because I'm hearing that doctor visits, hospital visits for non-COVID-related illnesses are way down, and doctors are fearing some people are not paying attention to their health needs.
That's a good point. One of the potential dangers of everybody staying at home is simple things like decrease in the amount of normal activity, right? The number of steps you take in a day, your dietary habits. I think there are all sorts of memes out there about dietary habits that have changed in these times. And what we don't want is people's chronic medical conditions to get worse, which leads to poor health outcomes in the near future and in the far future, because we've been so focused on these stay-at-home orders. So coronavirus and this COVID-19 pandemic, incredibly important. But we also need to think about chronic disease management and making sure that we keep our patients and our communities healthy now and into the future.
Dr. Johnson, one more time, remind our listeners how they can make a telehealth visit.
No problem. So two main ways. One would be just to call your provider's office and set up a visit. That way you can request a televideo visit or a telephone visit. They can set it up for you. The other way would be to go to SSM's website, which is ssmhealth.com. And on that particular website, there is a link where you can click on that link and schedule a telehealth visit that way.
Dr. Johnson, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Fred.
Dr. Tim Johnson is the System Vice President of Medical Group and Population Health Operations for SSM Health. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.